Following interview is a recording from the October 22, 2024 live edition of Tuesday Morning Beats Beyond the Border in the KURU Gila Membrez Community Radio Studio in Silver City, New Mexico. DJ host Mary McHugh and co-host Scott Plate shared a discussion with Tori Grass. For more information, contact Mary at maree@gmcr.org. Find Gila Membrez Community Radio online at gmcr.org. Welcome to Tuesday Morning Beat on KURU, Gila Membrez Community Radio. Tuesday Morning Beat brings you news, views, and interviews concerning social justice issues. This is the fourth episode of Beyond the Border, a discussion about the end-of-life journey with my co-host, Scott Plate. Scott is a death doula and a life coach. My name is Mary McHugh. Why is death and dying considered a social justice issue? Well, we make decisions every day about how we choose to live our lives. Those decisions and choices are often affected by and are the result of economic, political, social, and cultural influences. Situations that affect our daily lives, such as access to health care, clean water, safe and affordable housing, employment, education, and social support, greatly influence our quality of life. These factors also affect the support, care, and decisions we have available to us at the end of our life. There are laws and legislation that impact our right to make decisions about our own end-of-life journey. Our monthly program will provide an opportunity to broaden our discussion about death and dying, and in reflection, how we live our lives each day. We will explore how we can enhance our understanding and acceptance to embody autonomy and dignity, even as we approach the end-of-life journey for ourselves and others. The discussion will include end-of-life options, personal narratives, shared experience of the universal process that we all someday will face, taking perspectives of social justice into another, less explored dimension. We are all walking each other home. Our special guest today is Tori Grass. Just a bit about Tori. Tori Grass enjoyed a professional career as a registered nurse working in pediatrics, early childhood intervention, education of health professionals. She has worked in public health and hospice. She retired in 2011 to provide end-of-life care for her mother. Tori is deeply committed to her community and has been a volunteer for many nonprofits in the areas of health, women and children's rights, end-of-life issues, and she enjoys working with the Grant County Archaeological Society and for environmental concerns. Welcome. Welcome, Tori Grass. Thanks for being here with us this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invite, Marie and Scott. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's really our pleasure. You know, I loved your bio because it's not very often that you meet someone who studied art in college and then read a few sentences later that they were inspired to return to continue their education in nursing. And I'm just drawn by the word inspired to return. Can you fill us in on what that transition was like and how you found your way there?
Well, it was a long journey and sometimes very painful journey, but in retrospect, I'm really grateful for all the lessons I learned in the process. Studying art was a real joy for me, and it taught me certainly about art, but most importantly, it taught me who I was. It was a process by which I came to know who I was. And, of course, that's an ongoing process. You never stop learning that. But
sometimes the best lessons of a subject are not the subject matter.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And I have no regrets about having studied art all those many years. But the value for me was that it gave me a clear understanding of who I was and what was important to me in my life.
Mm. What was that? What did you discover?
I discovered that I wanted to spend my energy and my work serving other people and not just creating beautiful things that fed my ego. That's not in any way disparage artists. I feel that Mm-hmm. Artists are extremely important. My son is an artist. My daughter-in-law is an artist. And it is an extremely important path, career path, and passion. But for me, it was different. I learned a lot from trying to be an artist, and it wasn't how I wanted to spend the rest of my life.
That makes sense. I mean, I think of you as the purest definition of an advocate.
Hmm. That's a compliment. Thank you, Scott.
You're very welcome. But when I first met you, I felt your strength, I felt your warmth, I felt your commitment, and I understand why service is important to you. And I think, so when you say service, and what comes to my mind is serving something higher than
yes.
me. Yes. Because you talked about ego, and I understand that because I was a former actor, and
yeah.
that's kind of how that...
Yeah, it's a real trap. Ego can be a real trap.
I agree. So how do you transcend out of ego into higher service? How did it happen for you? Because I think I'm just intrigued by learning who you were. You know, I think that's what you are. That's my sense, is just service.
Yeah, I don't know if I could put that into words, Scott, yeah. Because it you know, looking back at my life, you hear the expression, but for the grace of God go I. I don't, and I think about all the bullets that I dodged in my life, and I don't know sometimes how I got to where I am right now, which is a very good place, actually, mm-hmm. internally for me.
Yeah,
it became clear to me that there was tremendous amount of suffering in the world, and I didn't want to add to it.
Yeah,
I wanted to, in my tiny way, decrease suffering. So,
I think you've just described how to transcend the ego. Figure out how not to identify with suffering, you know, in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was living in Tucson in the, when was it? The late 70s, mid to late 70s. I was driving a school bus. No, I wasn't yet. I hadn't started that yet. But I was doing jewelry making at a local artisan's shop. Mm-hmm. And Ram Dass came to town.
Wow.
And he had he gave a lecture, a talk at an outdoor venue in Tucson, and I went there with my then partner at the time, and he was talking about a whole bunch of things, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he talked about was setting up centers for dying where people could go mm-hmm. in a loving environment where their wishes would be respected. Mm-hmm. Where they wouldn't be surrounded by a lot of scary medical stuff,
mm-hmm.
where they could be supported not only in their comfort, but also spiritually.
Yeah.
And this was before the hospice movement really
Before Dr. Kevorkian, all that, yeah.
Yeah, it was before all that. Mm-hmm. And there was hospice, I believe, in England, in Europe, but there wasn't much hospice happening here, certainly not in Tucson. And he was talking about setting up centers for dying where people could go and be surrounded in love and die peacefully and comfortably, as comfortable as possible. And I thought, wow, what a brilliant idea. How could you get a job at a place like that?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you could be a nurse.
Hmm.
So I looked into what it would take to go back to school to be a nurse, having limited finances. And I figured it out, and I gave it a try. I mean, I had an art background. I didn't have a science background. So one of the prerequisites was chemistry, and I found that extremely intimidating.
Mm-hmm. That took guts. I got to just say, that just takes guts to make a paradigm shift like that. Good for you.
Well, it was a good move for me, but mm-hmm. but yeah, it was pretty scary. So anyway, I did that and graduated and started working and started in pediatrics and did that for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Had a child,
mm-hmm.
and then I moved here in '82. And back in '82, there weren't very many registered nurses. It was still the Hillcrest Hospital, so getting a job was like a piece of cake.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get part of your student loan
forgiven
every mm-hmm. year that you worked in a rural area that had a shortage mm-hmm. of nurses. So I moved here with my 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. And a big part of the draw for me was the 3 million acres of national forest.
It's a powerful, powerful forest we live next to.
Yeah, yeah. That was important to me, to get out of the city and mm-hmm. be close to nature, because that's what grounds me, is being out in nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an incredible story. So what I'm getting from this is ingenuity. Figure it out are a few words that I'm going to remember when it comes to you. I didn't know I was going to do it, but I figured it out. And here we are. So help me with the journey from pediatrics to hospice.
Well, of course, I was, when I first got into nursing, I was childbearing age, you know, so, and I loved kids and I didn't have any. Mm-hmm. And so that was almost a biological thing, you know, to get into pediatrics and to work in a nursery. That mm-hmm. was my first focus, really, was to work with newborns. Mm-hmm. And so it almost, you know, that's where I started. Mm-hmm. I did a variety of things, and then you know, the original inspiration to mm-hmm. work at end of life was where I finished my career.
And Ram Dass, I'm sure, planted a seed.
Oh, yeah,
that was a huge one. He became very interested in death near the end of his life.
Well, even before that, actually, yes. Yeah. And he's written a lot about it. And I'm extremely grateful for that seed he planted. And it's interesting, too, many years ago, when I was a kid, or maybe I was a teenager, I don't know, my father said something to me like, oh, you should go, you should be a nurse, Tori. And I just rolled my eyes.
As if.
Oh, Dad, I'm an artist, you know?
And it's interesting, I know you shared at one point that you took care of parents. You stewarded your parents, at least your mom, on the way out. So it's interesting to me, because when I studied to be a doula, so many of the people in the class were birth doulas. They started out as birth doulas.
Sure.
And the way one woman explained it to me, who was a birth doula and a death doula, and she was one of our instructors, she said, well, when I was a birth doula, I helped a woman try to wrap her body around a rhythm that was taking over her body. She was talking about contractions.
Yeah.
And then later on, I help people who are coping with the loss of that rhythm.
Yeah.
It just begins to dissipate. So that helped me frame the journey from birth to death in very practical terms.
And here's how I look at it, Scott, is that birth and death are the closest you get to peering over the edge at the great mystery.
Love that. Yeah.
You know, it's a mystery. And no matter how many years you deliver babies or you help people transition out of life, it's a mystery. I don't have any answers, but it's as close as you get to just peeking at that mystery, and it's a tremendous gift.
I'm curious, something's come up as you were speaking. Do you think that infants and dying people have anything in common?
I think that energetically and physically, being born is extremely scary and physically exhausting and scary for that little being, you know, getting pushed through the birth channel and the contractions, and geez, it's just, and then coming out, it's just got to be unbelievably scary for that spirit. And I think death is very much the same way. For a lot of people, especially people that haven't given death much thought, or people that have pushed it away, the thought of aging and dying, if people that have pushed it away, and we live in the kind of culture that encourages that denial.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I agree.
And I think the more you deny it, the more you push it away, the scarier it is. So I think there are a lot of similarities between birth and death.
I think what fascinates me and gives me courage about this is watching an infant, and I've never had my own children, I've never been present at a delivery, watching an infant morph instantly from basically an aquatic mammal to an air-breathing, just boom.
Yeah.
So its ability to adapt and make that quantum shift so naturally. Now, granted, there's sometimes there are difficulties and there's troubles in that transition, but it gives me courage to think about my ability to transition again. when I come to the end of my life and what I'm afraid of. I said, well, I got born and I figured it out.
You know,
my body somehow knew what to do. It gives me, I'm just curious from a medical standpoint or even from a human standpoint, does that make sense?
Well, I think that there are biological processes, automatic biological processes that occur at birth and also at death.
Yeah, the body knows how to die.
Yes, and the body knows how to get born and expand those lungs for the first time. Yeah, it's really pretty miraculous. And I don't have the answers to this, but we do have the option when dying, assuming we're cognitively intact, we do have the option of doing that more consciously. I mean, maybe babies do as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Right. I wish I could.
Yeah.
did I know what I don't know now, right?
A lot. That can be said for all of us, I think. As I see it now, with my limited awareness, we do have the option of looking at our own dying, our own aging, and our own dying in a more conscious way and make some choices as to how we want to do it. And here in New Mexico, you know, we have the choice of medical aid in dying if we meet certain eligibility requirements, and not everybody does. I think for me, it is less scary thinking of my own death if I work on aging gracefully. How do I want to do this? And sometimes I can do it okay and sometimes not.
Completely agree.
My mother taught me a lot about how to age gracefully, because she, although she was a feisty lady and we didn't always have a great relationship, especially when I was a young adult and a teenager, I watched her have to give up things. First, she had to give up bowling, which was very important to her. Because she had multiple back surgeries, and the doc said, you can't do this anymore. And she cried.
I'm sure.
Having to give that up. She loved it.
Yeah.
And then she slowly went blind. And then my dad died, and she lost her hearing, although she denied that. She said that it was all of the rest of the world that just mumbled.
Right.
So she refused to wear hearing aids. That's why I made sure I got mine. I wasn't going to do that. But I watched her give up things. She lost her ability to live independently. She survived my dad by 11 years. And she lived in Tucson until the last couple months of her life when I moved her here. So I learned a lot from watching her. And I learned things I wanted to do and things I didn't want to do. Like, I made sure I wanted to get my hearing aids.
I want to hear what's going on around me. Right? They say on deathbeds, hearing is the last to go.
Yes, that's what I've been told as well. But, you know, for me, it's like started already.
Yeah. I think it's giving up things. It's an interesting process because in a way, when we give up, we acquire something. So I'm wondering what you observed your mom learn as she gave all these things up, because you had a bird's eye view.
I think, you know, I haven't looked at it that way, Scott, but that's an interesting question. And so what comes to my mind is that she learned to trust people more. She learned to have more gratitude, I think, especially for me. She still was feisty, but...
It may have meant more. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. By the time she finally died, she was totally ready. And we were able to talk probably for 10 years about death and dying, what she believed. And she believed that there was nothing after you died. I don't think she was scared. Yeah. Towards the end, she had some cognitive
decline.
And so I don't know that. The conscious part of her realized she was dying, but I think on another level, she was very much aware of it, and she was ready to die because, I'll tell you this story. She had a pacemaker, the battery's usually good for about 3 years, mm-hmm. and then they have to be replaced. And she was 91. And she said, I don't want a new battery. She only had a couple months left on the battery. She said, I don't want one. And I said, that's your right, Mom. You don't have to have another battery. So we went to the cardiologist, and of course they tried to talk her out of it, which is their job. Right. I get that. But she was clear. And I said, well, does that mean she's eligible for hospice if she doesn't get a battery replaced in her pacemaker? And the cardiologist said, yes. I said, that's what she wants. That's what she wants. She didn't want any more medical intervention.
Okay.
So then I moved her here.
Okay.
She could be cared for most beautifully by Gila Regional Hospice team that I used to work with. And then she passed 2.5 months later, but it wasn't because her battery ran out.
No, she was ready.
She had a stroke and she was ready.
Well, it's interesting to me that, you know, your mom's decision to not receive any further help. The other side of that coin is one thing that she also, it seems to me, that she learned was how to ask for help.
Yeah, she did.
She must have known on some level that refusing this battery would have meant that she would have needed more attention from people. And that's her way of asking in her feisty way.
Right. And she was tired, you know, and I get that. And I think the better word for that is weary, physical and emotional, but mostly I think spiritual weariness of life. She was 91 years old, pushing 92. And she was done.
Mm-hmm. Run the race.
Yeah. And I think that there's tremendous peace in getting to that point where you recognize I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people say that. I'm just tired.
Right.
My mother said that as well. But question for you, Tori, if you can answer this. Your mom made some very, very important decisions for herself. So my question to you is, what do you think empowered your mom to be able to make those decisions in the manner that she did?
Well, that's how she lived her life. She ran the house. She grew up in an alcoholic family, and the only way she could survive was being independent and feisty and speaking her power, which was sometimes difficult to live with, but she survived. And so I think it was just how she lived her life. It was the only...
It was more of an intrinsic strength.
Yes, for her, because of her early childhood, which was very difficult. The 10 years that I had with her after my dad passed was just such a gift to both of us, because we did have a difficult relationship for many years, and because she had such a strong voice and was so overpowering, I had to leave in order to find my own voice. But I learned so very much, and so those 10 years that we had was just such a gift, because she came to see me finally who I was and appreciate who I was, and I was able to do the same with her with tremendous compassion and understanding about who she was and why she was the way she was. So she was consistent throughout her life, all the way through end of life. But I think a lot of people don't understand that they do have that choice of saying, you know what, I don't want any more medical intervention.
Right.
I've had enough. And that is not quitting. That is sometimes the wisest choice. But it's a very individual choice, and that needs to be respected.
It's natural as well, it seems to me, because I've never had my own children, never, you know, been pregnant, obviously. But the first thing, it seems to me, that a woman does with a child she's giving birth to is to push it out. And then the rest of the process is about learning how to, as you say, become who you are, listen to your own voice. It's natural to turn back to parents, especially very strong ones who have strong voices, for affirmation, for a sense of who we are. And then sometimes that voice grows so loud, as you just described, that you have to find your own way in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that your mom's empowerment, you know, as Mary was saying, was to take these matters into her own hands and make decisions on her own behalf. So she was seeing her own way out.
Yes.
In that way.
Yes. And she knew I would support her in whatever she chose.
And I think my gut is, because I had a similar, very feisty relationship with my dad, and he was the one, you know, who chose to be with me near the end. I think he knew I would tell him the truth. Mm-hmm. That kind of conflict, that little sandpaper we had there, which was some sandpaper there.
Yeah.
And it shaped me, was something he trusted, because it wasn't sugar-coated in any way.
Yeah, it was real.
Yeah, it was.
It was real.
And I'm gathering your mom coming to terms with who you were and seeing that was part of that affirmation for her at the end, because she knew you would support her or empower her to make those decisions at the end.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for having us on the show. For people just joining us, we're having a conversation. Tori Grass has a really eclectic background, started off as a creator and became an educator, and then a healthcare professional. And she's sharing how that journey kind of stitches its way through a life that is really about coming to terms with who we are. And I think, you've done a wonderful job, Tori, about kind of tracking that, because, and also through the lens of taking care of your mom and empowering her. What did you learn from your mom's process about your own death, about your own views of death?
First of all, the thing I learned most from my mother was resilience. Because she grew up in an alcoholic household, she figured out a way how to survive as a healthy human being. And she was a really good mother, you know. Mm-hmm. She certainly, you know, had issues, but she was a good mother. So from her, I learned resilience. That's a word that comes to my mind right mm-hmm. away. She didn't really have any spiritual background. My father was Catholic, mm-hmm. and she became a Catholic because he wanted her to, and we kids were raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. But that Catholicism came from him.
Okay.
She jumped through the hoops, but she really didn't believe it and wasn't attached to it at all. So when her thought was, when you died, that was it, you know, there was nothingness. And that's not what I believe. Mm-hmm. But what I learned from her, as I mentioned earlier, was just how important it is to let go of things gracefully. And that is what aging is. And you know, I'm dealing with it. You are too, Marie, at mm-hmm. this time. Most of our generation is, whether you admit it or not. So I learned how to do it gracefully, and or try to do it gracefully. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. Because it's a process, and sometimes you do it well and sometimes you don't.
Right. I think so. And I think, you know, we've all, as healthcare professionals, been in the company of people who have had both experiences.
Yeah.
So when you say gracefully, what does that mean? What does letting go gracefully mean?
That means letting go without creating suffering for those around you. That means focusing on gratitude and not, oh, poor me. Mm-hmm. You know, why me, God? Mm-hmm. That whole...
Mm-hmm. Narrative.
Rabbit hole.
Right. It is a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Those two things are the big things, is that, you know, I don't want to make more suffering for those around me, because in essence that makes more suffering for me. Mm-hmm. And I am so grateful. If I died tomorrow, I am so grateful for my husband, my son, the life I've had, the lessons I've learned, the places I live, this place that I live, this community that I love deeply. So gratitude is medicine.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I'm not sure of grace and gratitude. I think they do have the same root. Gracias.
Yeah. Yeah.
Graciousness.
Yeah.
I wonder what that is. I don't have my thesaurus in front of me. But it's interesting. It strikes me because one thing that happens on radio is we can hear each other breathe. And just a little thing that came through my head right now. And it strikes me that breathing is a great way of acquiring and letting go. over and over. We practice it our whole life, and we don't really know we are.
Yeah, and, it's unconscious.
And I think what you're talking about is making the acquiring and the letting go conscious.
Yes.
So that we do what we do with the grace, you know.
And mindfulness. But of course, at end of life, oftentimes there is that cognitive decline. And
right.
One, on a physical level, mm-hmm. can't be conscious of what's going on. I do believe that on a deeper level, even someone who has severe dementia understands what's going on and that they're dying.
I believe so, too. I think the body does keep the score in a way that I think the mind doesn't quite grasp. So that was my question. Have you observed people die who were cognitively impaired or impacted kick into what their body knew was going on?
And I think, yes. Yeah. It's like birth. Just like we were
you
talking
know what
about.
To do.
Yeah, your body knows what to do. You know, when a baby is born, the things that go on inside the body, in the heart, just mm-hmm. the heart alone, it's just incredible when that infant takes the first breath.
There's
significant changes in the heart mm-hmm. that are essential for survival. And I think that same process, that biological process, happens when a person is dying, but there's also an energetic process that I don't understand.
Mm. But you can feel it.
Yeah.
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 I think if that's what strikes me and gives me a little peace to hear you speak about this is just to remember that your body knows what it's doing.
Yeah, and that's when you're in labor,
mm-hmm.
Giving birth.
Right.
That's what I thought about the one time I did it
mm-hmm.
was, hey, you know, I can do this. Millions of women before me have done this,
mm-hmm.
and I can do it. Even though I've never done it before, I understand the biological process of it, but whoa, that next contraction's a real bugger. I can do this, you know. your body knows.
It's funny. My mom, I used to pepper her with questions about what was it like when I was born, what was going on, what was the weather like. And I remember she just was like, I don't know why you want to know all this, but I would always wanted to know. And she told me a story. You made me just think about this. I haven't thought about this for years. She said that she was having really a hard time with her first. My brother wound up being pulled out with forceps. She was exhausted. And the doctor kept saying in his harsh way, Eleanor, you're in charge of this. You're in control of this. And she looked back at him and said, I am? These things happening to her were not what she had experienced at all.
Right, yeah.
Again, though, I think socialization trains us to think that we don't know how to do things that our bodies actually know a lot more about.
Yeah.
And I think the ideas we have about death keep us from preparing in a way that helps us embrace, like you said, millions of women have gone through this before and millions of people have died before this.
Yeah.
So I think there's comfort in knowing that literally I did the research on this when I was writing an article one day. There are two people dying every second.
Yeah, I believe
in
that.
The world.
I would think maybe more it's now. Yeah. I mean, more maybe now it's more with all the
with
difficulties. But
exactly. It could be with war, you know, and those things happening. But the fact, it struck me, if two people dying per second, what if they could meet each other at that moment? If there is no time at that point where we don't know what's happening, oh, this happened to you at the same second happened to me. So there's comfort in me, for me, in imagining what's going to happen, even if I don't have a sense of it. Because I have faith that my body will know what it's doing.
And so the word that comes to my mind, Scott, is trust.
I love that.
Trust the process. And you have to do that as a woman in labor giving birth. You have to trust the process. If you resist it, if you fight it, you create more pain and suffering for yourself. And I think it must be the same way for dying.
In order to trust something, you have to know the truth. You have to know your own truth.
Yeah.
And for women in labor, there's a lot of support. Most women will go to a birth center where there'll be, you might have your own doula. You certainly have family. You have the birth center people there with you. There's typically a physician or a midwife, and there's somebody to receive the baby, and everybody is so happy. Now, the truth is, when you die, what I have observed for a lot of people who die, there's a just inextricable sense of loneliness because you're the only one dying right now. Mm. As a death doula, as a registered nurse, as a healthcare provider, as a end-of-life options volunteer, how can we help a person understand the truth? And is it true that you are alone when you die? Because you're the only person dying.
Well, that for me, I'd have to go into my spiritual beliefs about all that, and this isn't the forum for that. But from witnessing a number of deaths, I would say, no, you're not alone. I have witnessed deaths where the person dying saw, oftentimes, you know, a week or two before they died, they saw loved ones that came to them, visions of them. Was it real or not? I don't know. Who am I to say? I think there's so much energetically going on that our brains can't perceive. I don't have the answers. It is a great mystery. I don't think that we are alone.
It's such a solo performance.
It's a solo performance for those that are watching. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's a solo performance for those that are dying. I don't know that.
I hope to be able to ask the question.
Please send us a postcard when you do.
Yes, please.
Because I want to know. Because I love that question.
Yeah.
I think so, because we often associate loneliness and loss with death.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Even though for some it is a sweet relief.
Yes. Oh,
and
yes.
People say, oh, well, yeah, we're so sorry that person has passed, but boy, we're so glad that person is no longer suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Or that wife or that husband or that partner has to continue to take care of this very sick or very demented person, you know, who's become totally dependent.
Yeah.
And so we often associate death with loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that person dies, many of us are now alone because of a death.
Yeah.
And we have no one to check back with.
Yeah.
But it's a really important question, I think, because if we get back to the idea of trusting a process, I'm learning from your mother's example. She lost her ability to bowl, back surgeries, went blind, lost her hearing, lost her husband. Her world was being decluttered, for not talking about all those things as clutter, but things were being removed. And my question then becomes, maybe they're being removed so we can begin to kind of tune into something else. So if we are letting go of things, of the habit of living, the trappings of life, what can we begin to attune our attention to that supports trusting that process? And I think the grace you referred to earlier, the gratitude, the acceptance, and maybe the solitude is a part of the story as opposed to the loneliness. But you're right, absolutely right. That's been my experience as a doula, Mary, is the real bugger for people is I'm doing this by myself and I don't know who's there. Although, you know, I've been with people who are clearly speaking with people that I can't see,
right,
and a little embarrassed that they're seeing them and I can't, my father namely being one. And I really desperately wanted him to share that with me, but was a little too weird for him at that point. I respected that. But I think in a way, if I look at it, my husband talks about, he's a real estate broker. And when a house transitions, a house sells, very often what happens is the first thing they need to do is declutter. They have to pull, you know, stuff that's out that doesn't need to be there anymore. So a new owner can come in and look at this place potentially for, you know, how it might be. But it involves removing some of the objects that were there before that may be cluttering the view. So I think, you know, my own choice, as I can see it right now, of course, who knows how I'll feel when I get there, is I'm going to watch things disappearing and see what happens, what I begin to imagine, you know, showing up in its place. We'll see. And when I work as a doula, one of the questions I'll ask is, what do you imagine is happening? What do you imagine you're becoming? What do you imagine is going to happen? So all these, we're focused on all these things going away and the loneliness. So what is your perspective now? Because there's very little distracting you. What do you see? What do you imagine? And again, we don't know.
Yeah. And I want to make a point in that there's a huge difference between solitude and loneliness.
Right.
I do not like being lonely. And you can be lonely surrounded by people. Solitude is something else. And I personally love solitude. Mm-hmm. I have to have certain amount of solitude in order to maintain the balance in my life. I have to have a certain amount of being in nature in order to stay grounded in my life and maintain balance. This was even more important when I was working, whether it was with hospice or with newborns. Mm. So there's a real difference, and I think one of the things I've seen a lot of, and I imagine you both have as well, is as people that are in the dying process, they do a lot of life review. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is done by sharing stories with loved ones. Sometimes it's done in silence and in solitude.
It's interesting. You're putting me in mind of me sitting with my grandmother when she was dying, and she had lung cancer, and she went very quickly. And she was in hospice, and she was lying on her side along with everybody else in hospice. And she had a room, nice room. And one day I went to see her. She had not been up to do anything out of the bed for probably 2 or 3 weeks. And this particular day I walked in, and she had these bright blue eyes, which are a little bit misty at this point. And she reached out to me and said, "Help me up." And I didn't, I'm 20 years old, and I don't have any. I'm like, not for sure I'm allowed to do this.
Yeah.
And she was really insistent. She swung her legs out. She's sitting on the bed. "Help me up." And I said, "Nana, I'm not sure this is a good, help me up. I have to get up." She kept saying this over and over again. And like, I can still see her eyes. Like, and finally, after a couple of minutes going back and forth, I'm like, "Nana, why do you have to get up?" She goes, "I have to stand up so God will take me." And I'm 20 years old going, "Ugh, okay, fine." 20 years
the
later.
The die was cast.
20 years later.
No pun intended.
I can't remember. 20 years later, I got what she meant. She needed to stand, make herself distinct in some way to go the way she felt like herself. And she stood up. I helped her up. She had no strength. She stood up for maybe 10 seconds and then sat back down. And then went laid back down with this big smile on her face, and she was gone 2 days later.
Yeah.
I got a phone call. But when I think about solitude, I think about that.
Yeah.
That distinctness. It's like I can see myself really sharply against the horizon here.
Yeah.
There's nothing familiar that's going to distract me. And if I can learn to pay attention in my life when I have those moments, then maybe I'll be a little more prepared for that mystery, in a sense, because we all get in invariably come back to our spiritual beliefs. I don't believe we're alone either, Tori. I don't think I've seen too much evidence of it.
Yeah.
Watching people who are dying, and it's not my sense of it either. Because I love when Mary was saying, when you come in a birth center, there's this warm, vibrant community of welcome, you know. And I and it's not just me trying to turn a frown upside down. I really believe that the same thing is going to happen on the other end. And I can't tell you why I think that.
Well, I also think, you know, Marie, your scenario of birth is what I would hope for everyone. But as you well know, it isn't.
No.
Not all pregnancies and births are like that, where the woman is supported or the pregnancy is even wanted. And so the suffering of the woman during that labor process is huge. Same with death, I think. People die the way they've lived. And if you have not focused on connecting with other human beings, if you have pushed others away and blamed others for all your problems and become bitter, become angry, become narrow-minded, that will impact the way in which you die. There's one gentleman's death that I witnessed, and he had he really hated women. Mm. Blamed women for his sadness, his problems. And he died alone. And his children were not there. He had multiple children, but he was estranged from all of them. And it's just so sad, so very sad. So I think, you know, if you live with gratitude and you live with compassion and you have strong human connections, you're going to have a heck of a better death.
I agree.
Than if you don't.
In our community of healthcare providers, I often hear, and I've heard Mary say this too, and I'm hearing you say, we die how we live, you know.
Yeah.
So very often, you know.
Some people do. Not everybody gets a chance. I mean, there
That's true. That's true.
I'm just going to have to qualify that with.
Yeah.
Because there are traumatic deaths.
Yes, yes.
Sudden,
yes,
unexpected.
Yes.
Right. And people who are in combat.
Yes.
People who just happen to be somewhere where there's a hurricane.
A car wreck.
Yeah.
Unjust.
Things like that.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But a life taking its natural course sometimes feels that way. You're
yeah.
right. The injustice of it definitely mm-hmm. changes the pattern.
Yeah.
It does change the pattern, and we don't really know why that person had to suffer that type of death, but it happens.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think the suffering of the loved ones that are left behind when there is a sudden traumatic death is so much worse, because they haven't been able to do they haven't been able to do anticipatory grieving.
Right.
With my mother, I was doing anticipatory grieving for 10 years, really, certainly the last several years before her passing. But when there's a sudden traumatic death, particularly of a young person, you don't have that, and it's tremendous suffering for those that are left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How has death, for all of us, shaped how we continue to live our lives now? Just the idea of it. How does it shape our lives now?
Every day has to be a good day to die.
I love that.
When I was a young woman starting to question my Catholic dogma, there were lots of deaths, family members on my father's side, but I viewed them through, you know, the dogma of Catholicism, and it wasn't something I really understood, but wanting answers to those questions was a driver for me to try to understand more about who am I, what is life, what is death, why are we here, all those big questions that I'm still working on, actually. So the experience of death, other people's death, was a driver for me to try to understand who am I?
Right.
Why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it all mean?
It's an introspective and intelligent inquiry.
I think it is, too. At this time of year, coming up to we're fully in autumn here in Silver City, and the time of year, where All Hallows' Eve and Halloween and Day of the Dead, what many spiritual traditions say is the veil between this world and the next is at its thinnest. So what strikes me about this discussion of death is, for myself, it's closer than it was when I was 20. I'll be 63 in June, so I remember when I was 20 years old thinking 63 was just so old. And now I'm like, bring on 80, you know, here we go. But the funny thing is it's closer. And I think my own practice is to bring death from something that's on the horizon, just something I can kind of get my arms around.
Yep.
So it's something here next to me as opposed to this. And in reality, it is closer than it was when I was 20. And this time of year is such an example of surrender and release. There are leaves just kind of beginning to fall. There's a kind of gravity taking over the experience. There's less light available to us. So it's built in every year to begin practicing and using nature as an example. Because I do think everything breathes together to prepare our own, because we get a trip around the sun every year to go through this process and watch how nature does it. So, and if nature is, and our bodies are the little microcosm of nature, and our bodies know what to do, then I think we needn't be afraid.
The seasons of our life.
Yes.
And this is, we traditionally think about these things, but even the celebrations coming up.
Exactly.
Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm so pleased to share the microphones with Tori and Scott.
Thanks for having us, Mira.
Oh, my gosh.
Thank you very much. It's really been fun.
It is, and it's enlightening. I always come away with more questions too.
Me too.
After we have one of our conversations, and also with some really precious insight.
Gratitude.
And yes. Gratitude. So thank you, my lovely listeners, for tuning into Tuesday Morning Beat here on Gila Members Community Radio in Silver City, New Mexico. Take care, everyone. Be safe, be kind, and don't succumb to the chaos.